Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies online podcast. This episode marks the start of a new series where I'll be chatting to PhDs and early career researchers in American studies about what their research and their experiences within academia have comprised, about their current day-to-day schedules and any advice they have for future PhDs researchers. I'm very lucky today to be joined by Rob Fitt, a PhD in American history at the University of Birmingham, and Dr. Michael Docherty, an ECR and lecturer at the University of Kent. Welcome both. Thank you both for joining me. It would be good now, to, I guess, just to give a quick introduction about what your research entails and indeed what you've been working on like right now, if you're working on a chapter or an article or anything like that. But if you could just give us a broad pricing on research is. Rob, if I could start with you. Do you want to kick things off?
Thanks, Will. Yeah. So I'm just going into my third year of my PhD at Birmingham. And my project is using the Los Angeles 1984 Olympic Games to explore this whole idea of neoliberal culture, by which I mean how the doctrines of individualism, competition, and this sort of extension of a free market ideology into all the realms of everyday life, how this is manifested culturally during the sort of 1970s and 80s, which is the time when the neoliberal economic policies are being laid out and eventually reach the White House, the election of Ronald Reagan. And really at the heart of neoliberal culture are these contested ideas about the meaning of race, the place of the nation state, the meaning of the nation state within it. So yeah, it's a sort of a tug of war over defining America and the meaning of race as the Cold War reaches.
Excellent. So what are you kind of working on right now? You're kind of like deep in chapter work or?
Yeah. It's funny really, since March, I've just sort of been left alone with no other activities to do except sort of just really get your head down and get on with it. It's at the moment I'm on a chapter talking about the sort of the visual language of the games. So it's iconography, it's color schemes, it's sort of mascot, it's symbol. And what I'm seeing is it's sort of, it's a ripoff of sort of postmodern aesthetics, which neoliberal culture is borrowing and sort of co-opting, corrupting, and turning into something that can be commodified and sold on an individual basis.
Great. I've got some points I want to come back to you on that because a load of stuff in there. But Michael, if I could come to you, do you want to do the same about your place?
Yeah, thanks, Will. I work also on Los Angeles primarily, or at least my PhD was primarily on Los Angeles. Looking at a slightly different kind of chronological frame than Rob's, I'm a bit earlier. I was looking kind of between, the late 20s into the 50s, really. Kind of the decades immediately surrounding World War II. And what I was looking at really was the idea of the frontier as a kind of, as a myth and as a history, not to sort of recuperate it as a kind of thoroughgoing historical methodology, but to think about how the frontier as a way of thinking about American history was so prominent in the 30s and 40s. Particularly post-depression, the depression kind of activating a lot of big social anxieties that had previously come to bear around the end of the 19th century and the kind of declaration of the frontier's supposed closure. And those anxieties come back in the depression in the form of people thinking, this is kind of the chickens coming home to roost. This is what happens when you've got the United States without a frontier. And I take that as a basis for looking at the literature of Los Angeles in that period, in the 30s and 40s primarily, which other scholars have done before, but typically have done so framing the literature of that place and period as being about the loss of the frontier, this kind of tragic response to the kind of the end of the continent and the kind of the finitude and the circumspection that comes with circumscription. And I'm kind of flipping that on its head and saying that yes, the frontier is very important in these texts, but it's not about the frontier going away. It's about the frontier persisting. The frontier is this kind of very, very white-centric, very masculinist logic for structuring space, for thinking about how people access and move through space, and thinking about that as a kind of defining paradigm of the literature of that period. That's kind of reflected in the ways characters think about space, move through space, the kind of spatial identities that characters have in those LA fictions. And I finished that project about a year ago, and had quite a long wait for my Viva, and had my Viva in the first week of lockdown one. I had I was kind of a pioneer in the field of Skype Vivas or Zoom Vivas. Since September, I've been working at the University of Kent, which is where I did my PhD as a lecturer. So that's me.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both so much. I've got quite a few to want to kind of riff on there. But I mean, going back to having your Viva at the beginning of lockdown, I mean, how was that as an experience? I mean, could you even prepare for that, like mentally, considering it was probably something you hadn't even considered being a possibility a year before?
Yeah, it was a really strange one. And up until a few days beforehand, we still weren't sure how it was going to shake out. Mm. I think a bit later in the lockdown, it became, you know, more of a customary thing that people kind of knew that was going to be the only way things could be done. I was up in Newcastle at the time, which is where I'm from, staying with my dad. He was recovering from an operation, so I was staying with him anyway when the lockdown hit. So I'd been planning to travel down to Canterbury, have the Viva down there, and then it all went up in the air just a few days beforehand. And you're quite right, it kind of threw the preparation into disarray. But in some ways, actually, it was weirdly a blessing, because it almost made me feel less worried about feeling underprepared, mm-hmm. because I almost felt as if this is something that I can't possibly prepare for. This is unprecedented. This isn't something that I could have reckoned on, which in a weird way relaxed me a little bit to just go into it and see what it was going to be like. And, you know, there is part of me that wonders and will always slightly worry that maybe I don't know if I should say this, but perhaps I worry that I might have got a slightly easy ride in the Viva, because it was, everyone was so new to the idea of doing things online, doing the Viva in that format. You know, it was new for the examiners too. And everyone was a little bit off their guard and just trying to work out what that format was. I mean, it was still a rigorous discussion. But I was aware that it was something that was new and uncertain for everyone.
I think it's very honest of you to say that. I mean, I'm sure you didn't have an easy ride at all. But I mean, as someone who literally gets breathless making a phone call with nerves, I hate being on the phone that much. You have my utmost admiration for doing that. I've got a question for Rob, but because you spoke about your research last, Michael, I'll stick with you if I can. Because I was really interested about the idea of the frontier persisting and not ending. And I mean, my research, which would probably be helpful if I had mentioned what that was at the beginning, but as the host, I wanted to take a backseat. But it's on like small town America as it exists across 20th century America, particularly early to mid. And in a lot of the scholarship and literature around small town America, especially the kind of the West and more kind of the Great Plains, there is a figuring of the small town as being like the answer to the frontier's disappearance. Like as the frontier was settled, then these small little outposts in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the American world, almost become a response frontier and survival there. So it's interesting, obviously you're working on urban studies with LA, complete antithetical to the country small town. I just wondered, had you ever kind of come across that town and city division in kind of frontier myth?
Absolutely. And indeed, it's kind of that tension, that dichotomy that prompted the urban focus of what I'm doing. It is very much the idea that while, you know, those small towns perhaps in some ways are more, you know, when you think about kind of the 20th century small town, but also the kind of, you know, the forgotten ghost towns, boom towns, that kind of thing of the American West. Those settings, I think, perhaps seem more obviously redolent in some ways of the kind of frontier outpost, a kind of a legacy of that in some ways, you know, the obvious development of what happens when the frontier moves on. Whereas the thing about LA is it seems to stand in some ways as the ultimate expression of the frontier's demise. You know, you get to the end of the continent and then there's this sprawling metropolis.
Yeah.
And that also a metropolis that stands in is this, you know, and I'm sure this is something that comes up for Rob in a 70s and 80s context, the idea of LA as a kind of a capital of the Pacific Rim, right? As something that inverts or reorients these kind of conventional American directions of travel, right? So the idea that you go so far west that you're in the east again. LA kind of, that gives LA a kind of particular sort of fruitfulness in terms of how it interfaces with all these frontier myths. That is exactly what drove me to it, that it, unlike those small towns, perhaps it doesn't seem to have that immediate recollection of frontier identity. And yet in other ways, it is kind of tapos those myths.
Yeah, I love the idea of it being the terminus. It's almost like the gold at the end of the rainbow, the terminus at the end of the frontier, this place of, you know, of excess in maybe in the 70s and 80s, not to just kind of give it one characteristic. It's a very complicated place, as all cities are. But those associations with excess, maybe, it's interesting how it kind of assumes that the final finishing product. Rob, I wonder if you've got any kind of responses to that, but also wanted to ask you about... the postmodern aesthetics you mentioned, because I was really interested there. Because I guess you have the period you're looking at. I mean, trying to, you know, pin the tail on where postmodernism begins and ends is, you know, a fool's errand. But I guess it's kind of, it has its origins around the same time as you're working. So what are those specific postmodern aesthetics and how are they becoming manifest? And speak to anything that we've just discussed there.
Yeah, really interesting to hear what, Michael, you were just saying there about the end of the frontier in Los Angeles, and it's a really fascinating place to situate your research in that respect, because I think as you witness the sort of frontier of the imagination disappear, you see some sort of replacements pop up in LA, which is a city, you know, completely boxed in and divided by both physical barriers and imaginative barriers. And just listening to you talk, I was reminded of a quote that I've actually put in my dissertation, as I sort of try to go over the history of LA in a sort of a survey fashion before I get into my period. It comes from Chester Himes's If He Hollers, Let Him Go, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And in that novel, he's constantly reference things, as I remember, like how he drives around the city, which routes he is taking and why. And he notes that all that tight, crazy feeling of race, as thick in the street as gas fumes, every time I stepped outside, I saw a challenge I had to accept or ignore. And that's just something I was put in mind of as you were talking. To go on to what you're saying about postmodern aesthetics, well, it's something I'm only just sort of beginning to grapple with. And I was fascinated to come across a reading the other day that spoke about how LA is the quintessential postmodern city. So that sort of reliance on the new logical forms, et cetera, becomes abandoned. My take on it is the use of history and the nation state. So the imagery and the culture of America, American history, becomes this deep well of ideas that you can borrow from. And you can ram up against each other, you can juxtapose, and you present as postmodern aesthetics. So in the case of the Olympics, we've got the sort of the ticket booths and the concession booths that they set up, which are, on the one hand, they're like bright pink, bright yellow, aqua blue, but they're also modeled on sort of ancient Greece temples, would be one quick example.
Brilliant. No, thank you for all of that. It's really interesting. I mean, thinking of kind of urban studies and urban exploration and everything you kind of covered there about LA and it being a sprawl, I'm a bit of a fraud when it comes to stuff like that. Cause I mean, the most reading I've done really is Jane Jacobs, and specifically in her introduction of The Death and Life of Great American Cities, she implores people not to apply any of her theory to small towns. Like, she literally says that in like as much words as that, like, don't try and apply these theories to small towns. And in defiance of that, I'm trying in some ways to do that. But yeah, I guess the cities she's mainly describing, it's been a long time since I've read it, and Michael, you might be able to speak to whether LA comes up there, but I think New York seems to have more of a focus and kind of East Coast. But, you know, using that word sprawl, LA as a just a geographic construct is so interesting in that way. It is kind of a giant town rather than this canyon of skyscrapers. And again, that seems like it's a product of it being frontierable. A slightly more broad question, I guess, is that obviously, Rob, you're coming at LA from a historian standpoint. Michael, you're, you know, literary critic and scholar, and kind of you've both got a lot of strings to your bow and fingers of different pies, but you're coming at it from slightly different angles. And I guess, does LA and your perception of LA shift massively coming at it from a different discipline? Do you think your field and the way the lens you look at LA, is it kind of pigeonholed compared to other subjects and fields? It's a bit of a broad question. I don't really know what I mean specifically by it. So if anyone's got anything to riff on, by all means, go for it.
I mean, my initial sort of thought listening to that was the more I research Los Angeles, the less sure I feel about drawing any sort of concrete conclusions whatsoever. What is Los Angeles? You know, that famous quote, which I will probably get wrong, something like 27 towns in search of a city or whatever it is.
It's a great quote.
I wish I could remember who said it now. What even is Los Angeles? You know, I think trying to make any sort of generalizations at all are extremely difficult.
Yeah, I'm very much with Rob on that one. And that quote that Rob just gave about so many suburbs in search of a city is bang on. And the fact that I wanted to quote that in my thesis, and just as a kind of an aside at the start, as a way of discussing the difficulty of defining. And don't get me wrong, I could have devoted more time to this, but in the research that I did, I could not find a firm attribution for that. You know, it gets attributed to Dorothy Parker quite often, but there's no firm grounding in that I've been able to. And it seems to go back a long way. And the very murkiness of tracing that attribution says something like about the difficulty of ascribing firm narratives to what LA is. I think some of the stuff you said, Will, a moment ago about comparisons with villages, you know, that comes up a lot. There's a book, it's quite old now, 40 years or so, called Los Angeles, The Enormous Village by John Weaver, which is it's a kind of history of LA, you know, from its kind of Spanish mission days to when Weaver was writing at the end of the 70s. And then similarly, there's another study of kind of early-ish LA, 19th century LA, called The Fragmented Metropolis by Robert Fogelson. So those ideas are really prominent, but I agree with Rob that no single one of those narratives seems complete or adequate to me. And I think I'd apply that to kind of my own methodology, if you like, my own sense of my field, to answer your question, Will. In that, yes, I am primarily a literary scholar, but I mean, my PhD is an American Studies PhD from the Center for American Studies. And I tried to kind of take that sort of disciplinary obligation seriously in some sense, or use it as a way of reminding myself kind of to consider the different forms and the different media and the different investigatory methods that you might use to tell of a city, especially a place as complex as LA. So yes, a large part of what my thesis was the tensions that exist between literary narratives about LA and what's actually happening in the historical record. Now, of course, you can then get into even thornier questions of the objectivity of the historical record, right? But as far as those things can be traced, you know, you find really interesting narratives, pre-war versus post-war LA fiction about questions of sprawl, questions of density. Those don't always sit at odds with what was actually kind of happening in terms of, you know, development of the housing stock and the actual density of population in certain areas, et cetera, et cetera. So you're absolutely right that there are often kind of different stories appear about the city depending on kind of which disciplinary angle you're using.
Yeah, I mean, I love the kind of, I guess, almost a metonym for the whole of LA being that quote and struggling to find an attribute, as you say, like it being part of the myth. This kind of great quote about the city, and it describes it so well in so few words, but not being able to trace the origins of it. I've had that a lot with my own research, these brilliant quotes. I just think they're almost doing my entire thesis's work in five words, but then I can't actually find where they've come from. So, you know, I was like, oh, I can forget about them and just try and, you know, I can plow on ahead and try and do it, what that quote's doing. But yeah, that kind of latter point you said as well about being disciplined within what your field is, you know, as American studies, that really chimes true with me as well, because technically my PhD is in English Lit, but I mean, it is American studies as broadly as you can take it, really. I look at literature, photography, art, all these three things are intersection as well. There's bits of urbanism, mainly, you know, regionalism and stuff as well. So yeah, I guess obviously you all work on various different things, but LA as being this various and multifaceted beast is kind of like the same thing, really, with what an American studies academia journey is like.
Yeah.
So just talking about your wider research as well, if I may, and kind of going off on a bit of a tangent. Rob, you wrote recently for the Washington Post a couple of months ago on kind of the tainted legacy of patriotism, and it's how kind of education's been changed in Texas and how kind of narratives have been skewed there as well. And obviously this just seeps really nicely into your wider research. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about that article, how it came about, and yeah, just any conclusions you made?
Sure, yeah. This was all born out of the work I did, seems like a long time ago now, for my master's degree. Really fortunate at Birmingham, there's a pot of money available in the American Studies department every year for a postgraduate student to use for their research, for their dissertation. So I'm very, very fortunate to get access to that, and went out to Texas, to Austin, with a sort of a vague idea that I wanted to look into the politics of the state. I'd read up a lot about it beforehand, and there seemed to be an awful lot going on. And in the course of my digging around in the archive, came across a couple who, they've cropped up here and there on the internet, you can find them, and they're mentioned in passing in a few books. A couple called Mel and Norma Gabler, who are this sort of the quintessential white, middle-class Texan God-fearing couple. Mm-hmm. And the story goes that their son comes home from school one day and wants to know why the history book he's got at school doesn't reconcile with what Mel's or what his father's always told him about the founding fathers. And Mel takes a look at this textbook and just, he's rendered absolutely horrified by
throws it to the floor.
Yes, yeah, so the story goes. He's horrified by the presentation of American history in this textbook. Shows it to his wife, she's equally horrified. There's a focus on that sort of that post-war moment of liberal internationalism that followed the war. Not the sort of deeply conservative version prefer. And anyway, they launched this enormous campaign in Austin to critique all the school books and get the right written in there. Texas is really unique because it's so enormous. It's got such huge buying power in the market that there's a good chance that a lot of the other states, you know, California and New York can do their own. Well, a lot of other states just end up buying the books that are written to satisfy the sensibilities of people in Texas. So the whole disc sort of charted the minutiae of how they hijacked this whole process, and then went on to look at the type of history that was produced, which was this subtly conservative white supremacist retelling of America. And I was moved to pitch to the Washington Post about this because of President Trump's recent rantings and ravings about critical race theory and how education should be more patriotic.
Brilliant, thank you. Yeah, great point to end on, considering he's tweeting stuff like that and also retweeting Randy Quaid and strange videos of Randy Quaid's face zoomed right in, just slightly inane. Michael, I wonder if you had any responses to that, but also in your own, you know, research, has the dissemination of knowledge and what you look at ever factored in kind of the way the themes you look at have been repurposed in an educational setting, or I guess just general myth making and nation building in that way, and kind of gatekeeping its origin, which is in education? Are any of these themes kind of come up in your own work? If that's an unfair question, feel free to just completely sideline it and talk about something else.
It's not an unfair question at all, Will. It's certainly not kind of the primary, specifically with that kind of education system thing, it's certainly not the primary angle. But what my project is situated in is very much this idea of big dominant cultural narratives that America likes to tell itself about itself, or you know, did at one. And these things do have kind of sort of long-term present day consequences, right? You know, there is a link to be drawn between you know, frontier myth and all those stories that are told about it, and things like Trump's border wall, right? There's a great book came out either early this year, or I think it was last year, the hardback, called The End of the Myth by Greg Grandin. And it's precisely that. It's about tracing a kind of mythic legacy from the frontier right through to Trump's Build the Wall campaign. These ideas of American identity that are built on this weird paradox of strength and vulnerability, right? This idea of kind of a supremacism and an exceptionalism that actually subsist on the notion that there is constant threat, right? That's what the frontier myth is about. It's the idea that there's this great threatening wilderness out there that we have to keep moving into, because if we don't keep moving into it, it will threaten us.
Yeah.
So those tensions, I mean, really they're tensions between a kind of isolationism and a kind of expansionism in some ways. So my thesis, it was very much about the notion that those narratives were particularly prominent in the period that I'm looking at, that they kind of dominate the cultural imagination because they're being disseminated through so many different, they're there in the education system, in tech, but they're also, you know, Roosevelt and Hoover, you know, explicitly debating kind of the state of post-frontier America on the, you know, the campaign trail 82, you know, people like John Dewey, you know, big kind of public intellectual figures, Waldo Frank, kind of debating out this thing in the public sphere about what we do without the frontier. Those questions of kind of dissemination of particular myths, particular narratives about American history is very much what I'm kind of tapping into. And in many ways, the reason my thesis kind of ends before Rob's period starts very much speaks to the way in which that narrative, for all its dominance in American life, for all its attractiveness to certain groups, in a place like LA, it's really exhausting itself by the time you get into the 60s. When you find a city that diverse, that dynamic, it's very hard to kind of sustain this kind of incredibly narrow myth as a sort of convincing regional narrative. So that's kind of why my work ends as it does. But yeah, it's absolutely speaking to those similar questions. How do certain stories get disseminated in certain ways, for sure?
Brilliant, thank you. That was really wonderfully put. I've got another question, but Rob, I don't know if you had any responses or anything you wanted to jump in there. I didn't want to speak over you in case you had something to say. If you didn't have anything, feel free to just shake your head.
It's just a lot of thoughts firing in my brain. I'll try and get them out properly. What I found with going back to this idea of neoliberal culture and its willingness to steal from postmodernism's sort of bank of historical tropes is that the frontier becomes sort of individual. So we sort of focus on this idea of renewal out of destruction, creative destruction. The ultimate neoliberal citizen, I'd argue, becomes the Olympic athlete who's constantly pushing into uncharted territory. We've got to break down the records that, I picked up on a lot of what Michael was saying, and it's...
It's percolating away. No, brilliant. No, any thoughts at this point are brilliant to just speak out loud and vocalize. I mean, Michael, to come back to you, I know you in your correspondence with me before we launched this this podcast, started recording today, you mentioned a new project where you look at neo-noir as a genre, elements of neo-noir, and obviously Los Angeles being ground zero for neo-noir as a genre in many ways. So I just wonder how you found negotiating this aspect of genre and genre study. And I know my MA thesis was on women's narratives of the frontier, kind of stretching from 1890s right up to the 21st century. So
I'd love to read that.
Thank you very much. I mean, I'm not sure it's brilliant, but you're welcome to take a look at it. It's got some merits. But yeah, it's kind of, as you can tell, of a 110-year periodization, it's pretty sprawly. But one of the things I was trying to do was coin this idea of the neo-frontier. And I've seen the term a lot more since I've used that, just obviously in discourse. But I had a real hard time in theorizing just what neo does to genre, because like it's affixed to so many things like neo-gothic, and just it's we immediately know what it means, but from an etymological standpoint and breaking down what is this doing to genre, we affix it, I just find that really interesting. And everyone I asked about this, like lecturers and stuff, I was like, please help me, you know, get to the bottom of this genre question. They just sent me in the direction of neo-noir and writing on neo-noir, because obviously noir and then neo-noir are the two paradigmatic examples of just speak about your neo-noir investigations.
Sure. I mean, I can see why you were pointed in that direction, but I'm not sure that neo-noir is a place that is going to give you a concrete answer to that question.
Yeah.
For precisely the reasons you identify, that when you put that prefix there, that doesn't that doesn't come with a guarantee of what the prefix is, that prefix is going to mean, right? Mm-hmm. So when I think of LA neo-noir in fiction, the two obvious poles for me are Walter Mosley and James Ellroy, right? So on one hand, in Walter Mosley, you've got someone who is taking the tropes of kind of Raymond Chandler's noir. And, you know, I love Raymond Chandler. You know, The Long Goodbye is possibly my favorite novel as a kind of, as a reader who just loves to read for pleasure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Chandler's vision of the world is, you know, a narrow one, a racist one. You know, those things are undeniable. Sean McCann writes very well about that in Gumshoe America. And in Walter Mosley, you've got someone who is taking the kind of tropes of that world and saying, well, what happens, effectively saying, what happens if the Philip Marlowe figure was a black detective, right? What spaces would he move into that would be different? What spaces couldn't he? How would his investigations change? What would his social milieu be? And he's using a riff on noir to make a kind of radical social revision to a kind of fictional orthodoxy there. Whereas Ellison is undoubtedly writing neo-noir, not Ellison, sorry, Ellroy, is undoubtedly writing neo-noir as well, but doing so from an explicitly conservative and reactionary stand. It's always difficult with Ellroy because he likes to frame everything he does in a kind of sort of arch layers of irony, a bit like, you know, like kind of a Tom Waits type thing where you can never quite tell if Tom Waits is a character. Mm-hmm. But I think at root, you know, Ellroy isn't completely the kind of conservative caricature that he presents of himself, but there is absolute at the heart of his work. So he's using that legacy of the hard-boiled form, the noir form, to kind of, if you like, to return to it, right? So Mosley and Ellis and Ellroy are using a kind of riff on 40s LA detective fiction to do almost diametrically opposite thing. And that's part of what I'm interested in, is that the project isn't just about neo-noir, but neo-noir's at the heart of it. It's about trying to link my existing sort of mid-century LA interests with my other interests in kind of contemporary fiction, which I read, which I've taught on, which I'm just kind of thinking about because I'm, you know, because I'm interested in LA as a place and the kind it produces. So I'm trying to think about what the links are, the connections are between a particular sort of 30s, 40s vision of the LA canon that through things like noir still has a really dominant role in defining our images of that city. Even though the city it's describing, you know, materially very little of it exists anymore, the way LA's urban fabric has changed and demographically. So what kind of influences are they having over contemporary LA or more recent LA? How do those connections work between them? That's really what I'm trying to tease out. And in those divergent directions that something like neo-noir can take, I think you can kind of see the stakes of that question.
It sounds like a fascinating project, and you've summarized it really well there. I mean, Rob, it's not really a question I can level at you, a genre study question, considering obviously you're a historian, but I mean, do you see elements of that older LA being repurposed for the identity purposes of the Olympics? Are they kind of taking that period? Yeah. What are they doing with that?
So, I mean, LA hosts the Olympic Games for the first time in 1932. This is organized and campaigned for by civic boosters, so local businessmen, particularly real estate moguls, etc., to really put LA on the map as a commodified sort of destination. And one of the things they do ahead of the 1932 games is bring in lots and lots and lots of palm trees, which are now everywhere in LA.
It's become
the symbol of the city, and In my introduction, the first image I begin with is a palm tree during the 1992 LA rebellion when they're set on fire, and I use the palm tree as a sort of way, perhaps a little bit mostly, to talk about the history of LA and immigration. So here we have European immigrants in the form of these trees who have shed their European roots. They are quintessentially, and that imagery and particularly the popular memory of 1932 is something that is lent on quite heavily in the 80s.
That's brilliant. That's as perfect a response as I could have hoped for that question, which was unfairly leveled at you. I mean, we've been speaking about research for quite a while now, and it's been brilliant. And in the interest of, I could carry on asking you questions for all afternoon. I don't know how these episodes and the formats are gonna work. Obviously, we'll get a feel for it the more we do them. But in this final part of the episode, I guess we can just switch away from research and just think about the journey of academia a little bit more generally, in a more abstract way, I guess. I mean, it just sounds like such a basic question, but I mean, how have you, we talked about the Viva, but how have you found researching this year? I mean, what have been the biggest pitfalls and how have you negotiated them? Because I know a lot of people listening are going to have had the same things, and, you know, isolation and, you know, that lack of community, which we're trying to build with USSO and this podcast. I mean, yeah, how have you found it? Either of you.
Would you like to go first, Rob?
Yeah.
The million-dollar question now, Rob.
It's not been great, has it? No. For anyone, really. I just count myself extremely fortunate that I got out to LA when I did. I'd wanted to postpone it until April. Thank goodness I didn't, because otherwise I'd have been sat here since March with no sources to do. But, you know, it's. I think it started out as, for me personally, I had an extremely busy diary set up for April, May and June. And to have everything just suddenly is cancelled, a huge relief, actually. I thought, oh, great, I can knuckle down on my thesis. But now, you know, those halcyon days of June seem a long way ago. And it's, it's a struggle to keep motivated. People in various different with various different funding setups are all facing similar problems, in that extensions are going to be extremely hard to come by. Funding is going to run out at the same time it was always going to run out. So we're all on a sort of mad dash. So a difficult time to be doing it, but I can't say I've had it worse.
How about you, Michael?
Yeah, it's been a strange one. In some ways, you know, feels odd to say that anything about this year has been lucky. And, you know, whilst, you know, I went into my PhD thinking I had my eyes open about the state of the academic job market, et cetera, clearly something like a pandemic was not on my mind when I was factoring in career prospects, and the way that has kind of accelerated the crunch in some ways. But in other ways, I feel quite fortunate, sort of cyclically, if you like, because having, as I said, had my Viva at the very, very start of the first lockdown, I do feel that it put me in a position where I wasn't really in the depths of research, if you see what I mean. You know, I was fortunate in that I didn't have any corrections from the Viva, so I didn't have a sort of big new piece of work to go away and do there to revise the thesis. I was sort of, you know, carving out journal articles from the thesis, you know, getting revisions on journal articles done, preparing for this new teaching job after that came my way. You know, it's only a 1 year post, but I'm grateful to have anything in the current climate, really. And of course, there is this postdoc proposal, but really I'm in the sort of pre-research stage, like, you know, researching it enough that I can submit proposals based on it, but not the stage where I actually have to be knee deep in archives, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I've been fortunate in that the worst of COVID has come at a time when I didn't have major critical research activity required me to be overseas or collections or whatever. In that sense, obviously, I felt the general kind of sense of feeling a bit becalmed and a bit uncertain about the future and stressed and anxious and all those sorts of, but in terms of practical impacts on my research activities, I've been quite lucky in where it's fallen.
Well, thank you both just for being so honest and pulling back the curtain a little bit on what it's been like, you know, for you both personally, as well as hearing about your really great research. I mean, we can probably wrap things up at this point now. I'm not going to keep you here forever, but I mean, I've enjoyed speaking to you both so much, and I hope the listeners have as well. If they have any questions, I'm sure they can find you on Twitter. I'll put all the relevant info when this goes out. But thank you both so much for coming on and chatting. It'd be great. If you'd like to come on USSOcast to talk about your research and to meet other like-minded American Studies scholars, then please get in touch with us. USSO@bass.ac.uk. Put USSOcast in the subject line and tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'd love to hear from you.